Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDilling and I'm very excited to be here today with the amazing Peter Robinson.
Well, hello.
Peter, I checked the date of the first book in the DCI Banks series and I see that it has been 30 years.
Yes, it's my 30th anniversary and it makes me feel old. 1987 Gallows View came out and I had no idea at that time that there were going to be so many more. But, you know, he just won't leave me alone.
Did you have any idea when you first created DCI Allan Banks, the trajectory he would go on?
I knew that there were going to be two or three at least, because it took a long time to get publishers to commit themselves, and by the time they gave me a contract for the first two, I'd written a third, so that was the only time in my career I was sort of ahead of the game for a while. I've been playing catch-up ever since. But I had no idea of the trajectory. I mean, in some ways, not autobiographically, but it followed my life. I mean, over those 30 years, of course, I've grown older, things have happened in my life and family, and some of those are mirrored in what's happened to banks. You know, they're altered, of course, but, you know, the things that happen to all of us are not all of us, but a good number, things like divorce and, you know, children leaving home and stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, he's lived a relatively normal 30 years, and I've sort of followed that as well as having a case for him to solve in each book too. So it's been a lot of fun, and it's continuing to be a lot of fun. Gets harder, though.
Oh, how does it get harder?
Well, when you've done so many, you've used up a lot of stuff, and I don't just mean plot ideas. There are a few plot ideas. Some people say there are, what, 7 plots, 8 plots, yeah. Whatever. I mean, motives, you know, there aren't that many. You just work with the permutations. It's the individuality that you bring to the plots and the style and everything. But, you know, you tend to not want to repeat yourself and not want to follow a formula and not want to go stale. Mm-hmm. So you have to work harder as you've done more and more to keep them fresh and to keep them new, keep them, you know, yeah, ahead of the game. Yeah.
I'm just starting my epic read of all of the Banks books. I've been more familiar with the TV show, so mm-hmm. For me, I've just read When the Music's Over, and I'm now reading Wednesday's Child, and I'm so excited to be starting this journey, and I'm like so interested to see the differences between the TV show and the books, and I just wanted to talk to you a bit about that and how what it feels like to see your characters adapted for in a different medium. And strange, and does it affect your writing at all?
It is strange, and you try not to let it affect the writing, because television is so different, and you know, there are things you can do with just one gesture or one image in TV that would take you pages to do in a book, but yet there are things you can do in a book, such as a character thinking, or, you know, Banks sitting drinking wine, listening to music, thinking for 5 pages, that can work very well in a book, but would be boring as anything on television. So, you can't really confuse the two, I don't think. And I try to see my Banks rather than Stephen's Banks when I'm writing, and it works. It took a little bit of effort at first, because TV, it's right in your face, isn't it? And it does sort of stay with you, but I think I've succeeded, and I don't see Stephen when I'm writing about Banks.
Well, I didn't see him when I read When the Music's Over, which for me, that's a novel experience. Normally I like to read things before they're adapted. I'm doing it backwards now, mm-hmm. But it's always a concern for me when something that I've loved as a reader is adapted as TV or movie, that it's going to overwrite my vision of the characters. And I've never had this experience of being familiar with the story and being familiar with characters in visual medium and then reading the book and finding a completely different character in the pages. And not yeah. completely different, well, but just very, he didn't, I didn't see, I saw a very different man. And I'm finding that really fascinating.
Yeah, I think again, it's the nature of television that the character has to be a little bit larger than life and exaggerated. I mean, on TV Banks, tends to be quite emotional. He has outbursts, you know. Whereas in the books, he doesn't so much. He keeps a lot of his feelings and thoughts to himself, and you learn them because, you know, a writer can follow those things. Whereas on television, you actually have to show him emoting something to know what he's feeling. So he seems a little bit more melodramatic and histrionic on TV than he does in the books. He seems to be, you know, a more fiery, sort of emotional and you know, perhaps even grumpy character.
Yeah.
They didn't get a lot of the humour in the TV series.
I was just going to say, he was the Banks of When the Music's Over was, surprisingly for me, being more familiar with the TV show, sarcastic.
Had that
kind
of droll humour.
Yeah.
Very really Yorkshire humour. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to another question about the setting of the books. I've never been to Yorkshire, but the atmosphere of this book and the sense of place and everything is so strong, and I just wondered, you know, what it was that first led you to decide to set the books in Yorkshire.
Well, it's where I come from. I mean, I come from a city in West Yorkshire, Leeds, and the area Banks comes from is sort of invented, but it's a part of the Yorkshire Dales, so it's a mix of a number of market towns that exist there. Closest probably being Richmond. I was in Canada when I first started writing the books, and I was sort of homesick, so I thought it was a good way of staying in touch. You know, I mean, I could be there in a Canadian winter with snow all around, writing about a lovely spring day in the Yorkshire Dales, and it was the next best thing to be in there. Plus, I also liked the idea of that there weren't a lot around at the time, but books where you have a detective and a sidekick given a certain area of the country.
Yeah.
I mean, for a long time, crime fiction in England had been London-centric, you know, as the Private Eye stories were sort of LA-centric in the US. And that. But there was an outbreak of regionalism in the 70s and 80s, so the whole country was getting populated, you know, so you'd have Northumbrian detectives, you could have Cornish detectives, and, you know, I thought, well, the only Yorkshire ones I knew were Reginald Hill's, Dale and Pascoe, but I thought there were room for more, so I wanted to write that kind of book.
Do you think it helped you to not be there? Like, you just, when you mentioned that you were sort of having a longing for another place, it reminded me of, you hear that so often from authors like P.G. Wodehouse being, writing all of those books set in London when he wasn't in London, like,
and James Joyce with Dubliners well, Ulysses particularly. I think it did help in a way. At least it gave them a certain tone that they wouldn't have had, you know, if I'd still been living in England. There's a little bit of a nostalgic tone. There's also a certain detachment from the world you're writing about that you wouldn't have when you're right in it.
Yeah.
You know, so I could, for example, see the class system a bit more clearly from a distance. But I could also be at the same time rather romantic and nostalgic about the old ruins and things that I ignored when I lived there. So yes, it did very much make a difference. And I've found that now I spend more time in Yorkshire. Now I have a house there and spend a few months every year there, longish periods. It's really living there, you know, part time. That it's changing in the books, you know, the view of Yorkshire is less through rose-coloured glasses and just a little bit more how it is.
Yeah. I find it interesting. I mean, I've never been there, but I would love to go.
Oh, you should. Yeah, you should. Everybody should. Well, no, not everybody, because then it would be too crowded. But they had they started the Tour de France there a couple of years ago, and it was shown on television, and they were lucky, you know, they had a couple of absolutely gorgeous days to show the cyclists riding through this spectacular countryside, and of course it increased tourism no end, and now everyone comes with their bikes on a weekend, and it's too much, you know. We didn't want to attract that many people. It's a secret.
Just write a lot more books about people
getting murdered. Well, that's what I do. I go for long walks and come across interesting looking places and think, well, that would be a nice place to find a body, you know.
Speaking of that kind of thing, as a crime writer, do you find that it affects you, you know, when you watch the news, or do you worry about becoming morbid? Like, how much?
I think you start morbid. I mean, you know, I've always had a fairly morbid imagination. I can, I'm always told I can imagine things going wrong, and you know, or in any situation, I can see how it could get unpleasant or difficult or whatever. So I figured I might as well use that, you know, to make a living rather than just be a victim of it and lie awake at night worrying about things. Why not just share my worries with the rest of the world and make some money out of it?
Good thought process.
Rather than, you know, if I have a morbid imagination, I might as well share it.
Yeah.
Think about Stephen King's imagination.
Wow.
I mean, there is an imagination for you.
Yeah, my goodness. With your writing process, do you always plan it out? Like, do you know who the killer will be from the beginning, or does it sometimes surprise you?
It always surprises me, because I never do an outline. I don't know where it's going to go beyond the opening scene, and maybe a couple of directions suggested by the opening scene. So really it starts with the victim, who's probably the most important character in a crime novel. And in my novels, the victim is usually dead when the story begins. And the location is very important. As I said, you know, I'm always looking for spots to find bodies, and I usually begin books, not always, but usually with the discovery of a body in a interesting, sometimes inaccessible place.
Mm-hmm.
And then Banks and his team will start to ask questions about who this person is. And really the biggest question you have to answer with the book is, what is it about this person that brought about such a violent end? And that's the essay question you set yourself, if you like, that you answer with the rest of the book. So I don't really know until I'm a good 2/3 or 3/4 way through who did it. It could be any one of a number of people, but they tend to narrow themselves down. And it's not by things like alibis and forensic information. You know, that really is only useful in court later. But it's more by character and by psychology. What person is psychologically capable of having done it? And it's very easy then to give them a motive and to go back and fix an alibi, you know, so it's a false alibi.
Yeah.
He really could have done it. So those little things are easy to change. So I kind of wait until, you know, the kaleidoscope forms a recognizable pattern, and then I can see the end. But I'm usually, you know, a good way through it by the time that happens.
Oh, that must be interesting. Has it ever been someone that you really didn't want it to be?
There have been a number of occasions where it's surprised me to the extent that I've been trying, you know, I've got to that point and I thought it was someone, and I've been trying to make that work, and I found out it wouldn't work for some reason, and you feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall, and then you realise it's because it wasn't that person, it was someone else who you've maybe been defending. Yeah, things like that do happen when you don't plan it out. Yeah.
As a reader, that's always a sign, I think, of that I'm in a really good book, is when the killer turns out to be someone that I don't want it to be, because they've become sympathetic in some way. So
yeah.
That extra level of heartbreak.
Well, you know, maybe it helps you to know that the writer has no idea what's going on either. I mean, if I don't know, then I think some of that surprise and of some of the revelations should perhaps come across to the reader. Whereas if I were just joining the dots of a plot that I'd already made up, it might fall a little flat. Though I know writers who do work that way and write terrific books. You know, Agatha Christie used to plot everything to the last detail, and, you know, nothing wrong with her.
No. do you read a lot of crime? Or did you before you started writing?
I had read tons of it before I started writing. I started, you know, reading May Gray and Raymond Chandler and Maj Sjöwall and Per Wallu, the first well-known Swedish writers before the Nordic Noir thing happened.
Yeah.
I read P.D. James, Ruth Renner, just about everything I could get my hands on. But I read less now. I tend to read probably a bit more non-fiction now. I don't know if that was through research that just got me into reading more history and recent history and that kind of thing. But I do. I mean, I always seem to have a crime book on the go. But I don't run through them the way that I used to do. I try and keep up with contemporaries like Ian Rankin, Michael Connolly,
yeah.
You know, people that I know and see occasionally.
And I want to talk a little bit about music. Are your music tastes similar to Banks's?
Yeah, I sort of put the music in for myself in some ways. I mean, it would be difficult to have him loving music that I hated. Not that there's much music I do hate. The one thing I've done is I've said he doesn't like country and western, and I'd rather do myself. But, you know, he will listen to country-ish kind of music occasionally. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the music comes from what I'm listening to at the time. So some of it may be fairly new. The rock music will probably not be new. That will probably be 60s, like Floyd, Zeppelin, Dylan, and that kind of thing, because he's sort of stuck in that period, as I am. I don't go much beyond punk. The 80s, it all ended. You know. The other music, you know, the classical music, is stuff I'm often discovering, new works and new composers, new orchestras, new singers, and that's, you know, stuff that will be what I've just discovered, and I'm listening to the latest Angela Hewitt or Joyce DiDonato or something, and then I'll have Banks listening to it too, so it's an indulgence.
Well, and his love of music seems quite central to his, like, it's one of his quirks.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it says about him or people in general when music is that important to them and sort of helps them work through things?
Well, it makes him, I think, more than just a crime-solving machine, you know, he's not just little grey cells. And it gives him a sort of an emotional depth that on television they'd have to do in a different way. They left the music out of the TV series, mm-hmm. which always was a bit sad to me. But it does many things for him. I mean, it's a stimulant, it's an escape. You know, quite often it will take him away from his job. If he sits down in an evening with a glass of wine and a Mozart string quartet or a Schubert string quartet, he's, for a while at least, you know, floating, suspended, isolated from that kind of grimy, dangerous world that he spends his days in. But sometimes that absolutely same situation helps him to mull over what he's learned so far and to sort of zoom in on who might have done it or why someone might have done it. So it serves a lot of purposes. I mean, when the music's over, there are a couple of instances where he visits the victim. It's not giving anything away. And she is Linda Palmer. She's become a poet. She was a victim of a celebrity who abused young girls in the 60s, many years ago. And Banks talks to her a few times. She lives in this house, this beautiful garden, and it's summer, and they sit there. And the first time it goes, she's playing Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, which is the archetypal summer country piece of music. But she's talking about the terrible thing that happened to her when she was a teenager. And then towards the end, without giving anything away again, they're in the garden talking things over as to about justice, has justice been done, blah, blah, blah. And they're listening to Mahler's Ninth Symphony, which sort of just ends in silence. You know, just. And it's meant to have an effect. It's meant to have an emotional effect. I know you can't actually hear the music when you're reading the book, but quite a lot of people go and listen to playlists and buy the pieces. Yeah,
I know that I did. I wanted mm-hmm. to hear the sense of atmosphere created just by the mention of the music.
Yeah,
made me want to hear it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really loved that. I'm a bit in love with Banks at the moment. Like, I'm fresh off my discovery of Book Banks.
Oh well, that's good. That's good.
But he seems to have these such strong, you know, surrounded by strong relationships with people, but struggles with romantic relationships a fair bit, which is not uncommon, I guess,
mm-hmm.
in the genre. But I just wondered why you think it is. Is it for him more to do with his job, or his something in his character, or are the two things inextricably bound?
I think he has a bit of a blind spot for his own emotional well-being. I mean, he's not very good at relationships. He sort of messes them up or starts the wrong ones in the first place. I mean, you know, it's no secret that he had a relationship with Annie Cabot, who's one of the main characters. in a dry season when they first met, but it became untenable because they were working together and it was just very difficult to work with someone and sleep with them at the same time, as it is in any workplace, I think, especially as he's a boss. I mean, he wasn't having a power trip. I mean, they were genuinely attracted to each other, but it gets a little difficult. And he just happened to be surrounded by strong women, and I'm not sure how that came. I didn't plan it that way at all. But they're always turning up, you know, and like now he's at work, his boss is a woman, and his partner Annie at work is a woman, his sergeant Winsom is a woman, and now young Jerry, who's a probationer and is coming along very well, is also a woman. And there's really only one sort of man on the team, and he's a bit useless other than Banks. So I can see him going soon, maybe to be replaced by a woman, or maybe a real macho man will bring in just to shake everything up a bit more, you know. Yeah, it would.
And can we, I know you've got the 24th book coming out this year.
I do.
Are you allowed to tell us? I read the blurb and it sounds very interesting. Similar to When the Music's Over, it seems, I might be wrong because I'm just going off the blurb, but whereas in The Music's Over, they had this case of historical abuse that sort of calls to mind a lot of stuff that's going on at the moment, or has been going on recently, with Bill Cosby,
Bill
Paris, and cases like that. This new book coming involves a mass murder, and I just wondered if that was in any way inspired by real life events.
No, and it's because I'd never actually done mass murder before. I mean, I've done a couple of sort of serial killer books. I don't like doing them because it seems to me you've got to come up with a really good twist on it, you know, to make it original. But I'd never done a mass killer, and it begins with a mass shooting at a beautiful Yorkshire church wedding, like something out of All Creatures Great and Small, and it ends up like Game of Thrones. In fact, the press always call it the Red Wedding, you know. And but it's a matter of peeling away the layers and finding that it's not what you think it is. Time after time after time, you go in this direction and come to these conclusions, and then there's another layer peeled off, and you find you were wrong, and it's something else. And again, it goes into the past. I always like to bring up past events. And one of the things that Banks is dealing with in his personal life in this book, which you get in the second scene, is he's just been to the funeral of the first girl he ever loved. And they've been out of touch for many, many years. But he's heard through grapevine that she died, and, you know, he went to the funeral and sort of ran away afterwards. And it kind of follows him emotionally throughout the book.
I'm very much looking forward to that one. It's strange when you come into a series backwards, because now I'm going to go back and read all the earlier ones, having read the most recent one.
When he was a callow young lad in his, I guess he would have been in his mid-30s when he started out. Yeah, it's 30 years ago thereabouts. And happily married, so he thought. And the kids were still living at home. Yeah, you'll find it very different.
I'm really looking forward to going backwards, but I can't, with when the music's ever so strong in my mind, I'm really desperate for like that next chronological chapter.
The chronology is interesting. And I, you know, people ask me, should I start with the first one or whatever? And I usually suggest I start with the most recent one or within a dry season, which is in the middle.
Yeah.
Which was a bit of a breakthrough for me, again, in terms of having the story set in the past, but we're working with the present. So it's about a body found in a dried up reservoir, and it goes back to the Second World War. And I, you know, it was really one of the first times that I'd done a lot of research on a book. And so I often recommend that as a first one, or the most recent one, because I think I've got better, you know. And then I don't think the early ones were bad, but they were the best I could do at the time. And I think Banks has got more complex, and the plots have got more interesting. The books have definitely got longer too. So, but there are some people who absolutely have to start at the beginning, and, you know, I just say, you know who you are, and you will start at the beginning no matter what I say.
Yeah.
But you're clearly not one of those people, so you can dip in wherever you want. Yeah.
Well, I'm now thinking
the next one. Well, it's still one of my favourites out of all of them. Yeah.
I always find it. It's interesting when you ask authors if they've got a favourite. It's kind of like asking if they have a favourite child.
Yeah.
Demure and say, oh, they're all good in different ways.
But it's difficult, and you know, one's temptation is always to say the next one. You know, but and it's not putting the other ones down by saying I do have a soft spot for In a Dry Season, for a lot of reasons. Yeah.
Well, Peter, it has been so great talking to you, and really exciting for me definitely to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And podcast listeners, you can get all of Peter Robertson's books at Booktopia, including the upcoming 24th PTR Banks books, Saving the Ground, which isn't actually out until July, but is available for pre-order at www.booktopia.com.au.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.